Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. It's hard to open a newspaper these days without reading something about the awakening of the Chinese economic giant, a giant growing so fast, even in the midst of a recession, that surely it will soon eclipse every other economy in the world. But in a series of public lectures this week, Professor Deepak Lal of the prestigious London School of Economics argues that while China is no slouch, India is actually better placed in the long term. I spoke with Professor Lal earlier this week.
Now, you were here for a series of public lectures, and the topic of which is about India and China essentially taking over dominating the West and their traditional dominance. Has that happened already? When's it going to happen?
Well, it hasn't happened now, but it might. I mean, I think it's quite likely in the next 50, 60 years, if I lingered, I wouldn't be here, but I'm pretty certain by then it's almost inevitable in a way. And if you go back in time, I mean, I like going back, say, 0 AD, where it all started. There were three
it's
great...
It's a nice round figure, isn't it? That's
yeah.
A good place to start.
You start. Beginning of 2 million. So if you look at, roughly speaking, what standards of living, there are three great imperial systems, Rome, China, and India. And they were roughly the same standard of living. Then after the collapse of Rome, essentially the West has collapsed. Someone described them as dung heaps of states, and the standard of living really plummeted. And it took, till about the 11th century before we had a very slow ascent of the West. And it was not till about 1800 that the West overtook India and China. But then, partly because the India and China was, you know, the large, fairly stable economies which had fairly unchanged methods of making a living, mainly rural, the Industrial Revolution changed all that, and this is the Western event. That led to this phenomenal rise in standards of living in the West compared to India and China. So India and China never declined. It was a relative decline. And what has happened in the last, 20 years, is that at long last, India and China, the complex regions, have finally woken up. And they're now industrializing, doing essentially what the West did over 300-400. But the only thing is, because technology is there, they don't have to invent it. They can actually just absorb this. And this phase of catch-up, where you can grow at 8-10%, Japan did it, Korea did it, Taiwan did it, but these are huge countries which are doing that. And it won't be till, at least another 20, 30 years before they'll actually eat standards, living standards, roughly speaking, those of the West. It's a long time ago. So
what we're already seeing, I think, I believe it was a couple of years ago, we saw the Chinese oil consumption finally reach America's oil consumption. We are starting to see China owning, effectively, a lot of the debt that the U.S. has. So while they haven't maybe caught up in terms of standard of living, are they already overtaking countries in terms of their consumption, in terms of their overall wealth?
Well, I think certainly as far as resources are concerned, there's no question that they're going to be a huge demand for resources, both India and China, very large populations. Just if you start projecting, let's say, the per capita consumption of things like oil, etc., which the U.S. consumed, and you start putting these figures to per capita consumption of India and China, you get huge figures. But I don't think that's going to happen, partly because technology now is advancing to allow efficiency in this. The Chinese are now in a big way trying to improve energy efficiency. And I'm sure by the time they're anywhere close to that sort of per capita consumption, you won't be consuming that. But there are, no doubt about it, a huge amount of resources. As far as the debt is concerned, that's a double-edged sword. You remember Japan in the late 80s, there were books being written, Japan is number one. Japan was buying up. The Japanese had huge reserves. They're buying up Hollywood. They're buying up all these museums. I think the Metropolitan, not the museum, but that huge complex around the Metropolitan Opera. They bought all that up, Impressionist paintings, and then they had a crash and it's all gone. So the similarly, the Chinese, I mean, there are two things. It's true, the Chinese hold a lot of debt. What are they going to do with these dollars? And ultimately, it's almost on the cards. That's what they were terribly worried about. Bernanke might inflate away the debt. He just raises the money supply, and very soon these dollars are worth virtually nothing, pieces of paper.
What does that debt do at the moment and possibly in the future in terms of the geopolitical power?
That is, in a sense, it is a threat. I mean, no question about it, because, the fact is the Chinese have some sort of, I mean, they can threaten to sort of get rid of the debt. But, you know, I think it's, as I said, a double-edged sword. I don't think they can actually do it. And the West has to keep its nerve. And I think that's the trouble. One of the sad things about the Obama administration is that I think the foreign policy has been all over the place, and they really don't know what to do. Some of the issues have taken up with China is, I think, silly. But the other issues, like security, what's happening in these Spratly Islands, etc., I think that's pretty serious. And they've laid down a marker, they're not going to leave. But there's no reason why the debt in itself at the moment should, the Chinese held debt, what they should worry about is the fact that their fiscal stance is completely unsustainable. And that's within the power of the U.S. to actually change that.
The U.K., I think it was last week, announced that they were going to try and run a balanced budget, the government, for the
first
time.
I think that is... I mean, New Zealand was one of the first countries which actually showed how you could do this. You know, huge entitlement economies, you can turn around. And that happened in Australia the last 20 years. And both these countries have done extremely well compared to, let's say, America or Europe, where they've not bitten the bullet. The Brits have done it. Partly because they're frightened of what's happened in Greece. But, I mean, that's the problem now. For most of these, the Western economies, they've just got overextended welfare systems.
Brits may not be able to do it for that long if they don't get that much of a term in government, though, don't
well,
they?
Well, that's the trouble. I mean, this is all political. I'm not sure whether the Americans are willing to bite the bullet yet.
Just to pick you up on something you said said earlier, you said that it's only been in the last 20 years that China and India have finally come online, if you will. Why do you think it took that long? I mean, it's hardly been a secret what the West have been up to for the last couple of hundred years.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a pattern here. Many countries, non-Western countries, I call them the rest, it is a portmanteau term, they were really traumatized by the rise of the West. And, of course, in many cases, China and India were actually colonized, similarly to Africa. And the elites in these countries have had this terrible problem of how do they reconcile modernity with tradition? They want to maintain their, you know, traditional societies, which culture, whatever you like to call it, but they also want to acquire these aspects of modernity which give them the power to, in fact, not let this happen to them again. And there have been three responses, essentially. You can still see them playing out in the world. One is what I call the response of the oyster. You just close your shell and say, you know, I want to get off the world. I don't want anything to do with the rest of the world. The Islamists today, they represent this. The jihadis going out, they want to go back to the Middle Ages. The second response is what Japan did. As soon as they saw these black devils appear, they said, oh, we can't beat them, let's join them. So they completely, and they thought that they could westernize without in some senses giving up their, or accept modernity without giving up their traditions.
Which has been true to an extent.
Which has absolutely true. Mm. I mean, you go to Japan, I mean, Japan, look, they look like us, but they are not. They're still Japanese.
What does the West, we'll start to wrap up, what does the West have to fear, if anything, from China and India overtaking them economically?
Well, I tell you this is a real irony, and here China is not very well placed. You know, when I was growing up, one of the terrible things which people feared was huge populations. So there's huge movement to restricting populations. Now, I think this has happened naturally in many countries, because as people get richer, they want better quality of children rather than quantity, and this has led to this, economists call it the demographic transition, country after country. Now, the Chinese forced this by having one-child family. What this has meant is that they will start aging in about 2025. So you'll have, I mean, at the moment they've got all this huge demographic boom which is giving, but that is going to end soon. And that'll be well before they reach standards of living in the West. Okay? So you'll have to cope with the same problems with aging societies in the West with much higher standards of living and coping with at a much lower standard of living.
And so what we're dealing with in New Zealand at the moment, which is raising the retirement age yet again.
Yeah, that'll happen much, much earlier. Happened much, much earlier in China. And that, in a sense, yes. Now, India is much better off, you see. This doesn't happen until, I don't know, 2050 or 2060. So it's got a huge way to go. And there's one reason why I think that in the long run, the growth prospects, the economic prospects of India are probably brighter than that of China. So that's one factor. The second factor, of course...
You wouldn't be biased, of course, would you?
I'm not biased. I mean, I've been one of the most fiercest critics of Indian economic policy in my time. I don't think I'm very welcome to talk about the Indian economy in India. So the Chinese, still the Chinese have got a long, long way to go. So that's one. But now the second point which I want to make, which is very important. I had a very good friend, Julian Simon, who was one of the few people who kept his head when all these population scares were going around. And he said, population growth is really a good thing. And his argument was a very simple one. You take intelligence as being normally distributed, the bell curve. Okay. Now, the larger the population, with the same number of people in the genius tail, there'll be more geniuses. Hmm. Now, India and China, as a result, have this potential once they reach the next stage where you really, you have to have new technology, you really need technical progress. What you really need are really gifted people. At the moment, America is able to attract these people from all over the world. But once these countries have, grown, they offer their scientists and all their educated, highly skilled people a better standard of life, they won't be able to get them. They'll stay in China and India. So I think in the long run, if you really want to see when they'll overtake the West, it'll be when they've set up their own Silicon Valleys, all these high-tech things in these countries. And at that stage, because many of these countries, the education system has gone to hell, they're not going to be able to import the talent from abroad. And that's when I think the West will really have to worry.
Fascinating. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
That's Professor Deepak Lal from the London School of Economics. After the break, making Billy Apple immortal and the soulful sounds of Lady Six.